Love Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, welcome to Yada Yada. My pleasure to be here with you. It's a wonderful Shabbat. We've got Kirk and JB back after his long drive from the People's Republic of Texas up there to Minnesota. How are you, fellas?
Doing good.
I've got a couple of numbers for you. The first one is 800 billion. Sounds like a big number, doesn't it? 800 billion.
That's pretty good size.
I don't think anywhere you can do.
That's true. The Trumpster is a pro-military, pro-spy, pro-torture president. And he has decided that that even though America's military and spy apparatus combined was larger than the rest of the world's combined, there were 250 countries in the world, we spend more on spying and on our military than the rest of the world combined. We represent, 4% of the world's population?
Mm-hmm.
So he decided that that wasn't enough, and he wanted to increase from just over $600 billion to $700 billion, the U.S. military budget, and then you have to tack on another $100 billion for all of our various spy agencies. $800 billion a year. And I want to tell you, what did we get for our, last year it was $700 billion between the two. What did we get for it?
We're in more danger.
A lot of debt.
We're broke.
Yeah, a lot of debt, a lot of people mad at us. A lot of people killed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next number is, it's a really big number, $4.5 trillion. The article says I have a Amazon Echo behind me, and when I said $4.5 trillion, it responded by saying, I don't know about that one. Well, I don't think a lot of people do either. Personally, the person who wrote the article doesn't know anything about it. They say that the Fed has a problem. It's a $4.5 trillion problem. The Fed, as I shared on Shattering Myths many times, decided that it was essentially impossible to sell U.S. Treasury bonds, and that the amount that America needed to borrow during the George W. Bush years and the Obama years was so staggering in terms of, in the range of, between all of those years, $14 trillion. And we couldn't sell the bonds. We couldn't get pension plans to buy them. We couldn't get government agencies to buy. We couldn't get foreign countries to buy. We couldn't get individuals to buy. No one would buy the bonds. And so what the Fed did, according to this article, is it bought $4.5 $5 trillion worth of bonds. But the Fed doesn't have any money.
No, they don't even have
any reserves. The Fed's not a bank in the sense of it has investors. There are no investors in the Fed.
The Fed is pretty much done printing more money.
Except they don't print it.
You value the currency some more?
Yeah, they don't print it. They just created the illusion of $4.5 trillion to use the illusion of the 4.5. Yeah, but mm-hmm. that's like saying, okay, I've got monopoly money here, and I've got 2,500 bills and $2,100 bills, and what I think I'm going to do is add 50 of both of them. Well, if he values all of it, you know, if you and I were playing. And you had half of the currency in the bank, and I had half of the currency in the bank, and then all of a sudden you quadrupled the amount of currency in the bank, but left us where we were. You have devalued our holdings.
Yeah.
And so the Fed devalued America's assets. By $4.5 trillion, and nobody is saying, wait a minute, this was smoke and mirrors. This was an illusion. This was a magic trick. You know, this is like the Wizard of Oz with all of the steam and the smoke and the flashing and blinking lights and having that little whiny dude, you know, step out behind the curtain when he's just sitting there pulling levers trying to impress people. $4.5 trillion. And it didn't cause Americans to lose faith in their economy or their currency. That's pretty amazing. Those are my two numbers of the day. We're going to return to the Torah, the first book, Bereshit, but I was just so flabbergasted by them and how they're being celebrated as a good thing. Yeah, this article in Money magazine says that's a really good problem the Fed has. It's going to try to actually sell those $4.5 trillion worth of bonds to get them off their balance sheet. Oh, boy. Yeah, I guess this guy never was an economist that wrote this. This is we are pursuing the study of henna. It was deployed a second time in Bereshit 6:13. Yahweh was encouraging Noah. Noah is the actual name, the hard CH at the end of his name, to look up and pay attention because, in God's view, the region surrounding him had been overwhelmed with cruelty and violence. For there to be any hope of a relationship, for man to persevere and not wipe himself off the face of the earth in endless wars. And, you know, you look at the history of civilizations, and it doesn't matter the civilization. That they operated on slavery. Women had no rights. All neighboring peoples were harassed. They were taxed. Their sons were forced into the military. If you didn't capitulate, you were tortured, starved to death. Mm-hmm. You know, they were all worshiping the sun, the moon, the stars, the elements as gods. There was this interconnection between the cleric and king to create mutual exclusivity in the control over the people. And it was endless wars, endless conquests, endless war.
And child sacrifice.
Human sacrifice. And this is not just Rome, not just Greece, Sparta, Carthage. It's not just the Mayans, the Incas, the Aztecs, the Peloponnesian peoples. It's not just the Chinese. Not just the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Egyptians. Everywhere you look, that's the history of civilized man, of violence and war, subjugation, enslavement of peoples. It's a hideous thing. I mean, man's propensity to be abusive is mind-boggling. And that's essentially what God is telling Noah. That this creature that I created and gifted with the Salma so that they could reason has used their ability to think to be a butcher, to slaughter animals, hunt for fun, as if killing were a sport. To take women just because they're fun, playthings. You know, it's like Trump met the Prime Minister of France's wife and says, well, isn't she pretty? She's got such a nice figure. She's in such good shape. I mean, that's like saying she's a sexual object. It's not like, I met your wife, we had a lovely conversation. She's really charming. Well, she's a wonderful conversation with Stella. Strictly physical assets. But anyway, that's the nature of the world. And you know, that comes at a time that, you know, we're talking about this, that the United States increased its military budget to $700 billion a year. So this story sheds light on the... Pardon?
What do you suppose they'll do with that budget? I mean, what more can we do other than invade everybody we've invaded?
I mean, we'll commission more aircraft carriers.
Yeah, which are
and battle doing? Groups. We will deploy more joint strike fighters. We'll update more spy satellites. We'll add more computers to the and more ways of stealing information from people and depriving them of privacy through the NSA and CIA. You know, more guns, more bombs. We'll have DARPA invent some really menacing weapon systems. We'll become extra special, really good at killing. You know, I saw pictures today of Mosul. I don't know if any of you have seen the pictures of Mosul.
Not recently, no.
Oh. Well, it makes Homs look like a garden party. Homs, the city in Aleppo, the city is in Syria. What I said was when the United States and Iraq announced that they were going to push the Islamic State out of Mosul, my response was, why? That's the dumbest idea I have ever heard. Yeah, I understand. The Islamic State are savages. But the only reason the Islamic State exists is because the Shiites were savages to the Sunnis in Iraq. And so you're just going to replace one savage group of people with another group of savage people. And in the process, you will leave Mosul uninhabitable. That means 1 million people are going to be refugees or dead.
Yeah.
And, you know, if the goal is just to wipe the place out, how is that a solution? You know, why would anybody pursue a policy that's going to leave a city of 1 million people uninhabitable? And that's the way it is. It's just heaps of rubble. This is what man does. We don't think. You know, my son is in law school. He was talking about this this case, and it was somebody was celebrating BJ Day, the Victory in Japan Day, and Americans were just like over the top. Boy, aren't we great! Let's celebrate the our victory over Japan, and it's breathtaking to me that we sacrificed 300,000 lives to avenge the of our own young people's lives to avenge the death of 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
How is sacrificing 300,000 of your own children?
And that's only the dead. That's the ones who were wounded.
That's just the dead. And that doesn't,
or psychologically
doesn't
scarred.
Count how many mm-hmm. Japanese women and children we yeah. slaughtered, which was, you know, millions.
Puppet bomb.
Yeah. Why would you celebrate that? Why is that a good thing? Why is that something that you would say, that's the greatest generation? Boy, we really showed up. Let's celebrate. How stupid.
Okay, it's worth celebrating because it meant we ended it and we stopped wasting lives, but to call it a victory?
But it was the most inane response.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they weren't defending America. Japan wasn't going to invade America. Yeah, they put a couple of hundred troops in Alaska to prevent America from figuring out, well, the way to wage this war is to fly bombers from Alaska to Japan. And so they put a small garrison up there in Alaska, but they didn't try to build a settlement for them. They didn't build defensive fortifications for them. They were just to be a little bit of a menacing force and to dissuade America from doing the intelligent thing. But I don't understand why anybody can think that sacrificing 300,000 lives to avenge the death of 3,000 is a good thing.
And you know it during the World War II. I'm sorry.
Well, you look at
World War II, another byproduct. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, World War, look at the most recent war, Kirk. We've Muslims, mostly Saudi Arabians, 85% of them are Saudi Arabian citizens, flew planes into three of our buildings, and they killed 3,000 Americans. And we directly sacrificed 10,000 Americans by invading Iraq and Afghanistan, countries that had absolutely nothing to do with it. There wasn't a single Iraqi or Afghani that had anything to do with 9/11. And we lost three times the American servicemen to avenge the death of 3,000. And worse than that, 200,000 have since committed suicide upon their return.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And the University of Brown study was, what, about $4 trillion wasted?
Yes, $4
trillion. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we squandered $4 trillion, making two bad situations much worse.
But, you know, the only thing, let me just sneak one thing in there. The only connection that people seem to always miss is at the end of World War II, we had squandered 95% of our oil reserves. And that's
right.
When we first connected with making the House of Saud our bestest friend.
Yeah, and you think of that we just sold $300 billion worth of weapons to them. It's a dictatorship. I thought America was opposed to dictatorships. It's a dictatorship that is the principal funding mechanism for fundamentalist Islamic jihadists worldwide. Nothing even comes close to the House of Saud in terms of funding Islamic jihad. And it's a nation that enslaves more people than probably every other country in the world combined. And it's a country that won't even allow a woman to go out of the house without a male escort. And that's our bestest friend. If you're known by the company you keep, well, then we're rotten to the core. And we send our president over there and he does a sword dance with these disgusting human beings. All the while, we put more sanctions on Russia. And then we're putting sanctions now on China. This is really intelligent. So, henop was the word that we began pursuing because Yahweh used henna to introduce what is really a profound statement in Yahshua 3:1, where God says that after going through and denouncing the influence of religion and politics, and just lambasting how these two human institutions have been so utterly destructive. God says, for that reason, Hannah, pay attention now, especially to the details. I am going to withhold from Yisrael my support for life. And so I decided that it would be interesting to track Hannah's use through the Torah to see when it's deployed, to see if God uses it as he did there to get our attention. You know, as a result of religion, religion had become so pervasive in Yisrael that God said, I am now withholding my support for life. Yahweh recognized that man had become so violent during the time of Noah that he said, I've got to reboot the system. We've got to start all over again. It is very possible, and it occurs often, that man becomes unsalvageable, that there is no hope. I've said many times, JB, that there's no hope for America. Make America great again. If you're buying into that, you are a lost soul. It is not salvageable.
It was never great to begin with.
As a whole, is not salvageable. If you're religious, you're not salvageable. If you're overtly political or patriotic, you're not salvageable. No amount of evidence and reason is going to save you from your belief systems. And that was the condition that Yahweh noticed during the time of Noah. So this is a really profound introduction. And I'd like to read it as just Bereshit 6:1 through 6:4, with amplified, but not with every word diagnosed and analyzed. And then we'll go back and see what we can look at, learn by just analyzing each word.
Okay.
Indeed. When the defilement and slain, the profane nature, the contemptible attitude, and the disgraceful wounding of the descendants of Adam came to exist on an ongoing basis, it increased dramatically, growing to the point of being multiplied in a myriad of ways, reaching into the tens of thousands of them, shooting arrows at one another within the area and before the presence of the descendants of Adam. And the daughters were born to them, and the sons of the Almighty saw that the daughters of Adam were indeed desirable and valuable. So they grasped hold of and took for themselves women from any which, as a result of their relationships and the benefit of their ways, they chose. Then Yahweh said, my spirit shall not remain nor abide with the descendants of Adam forever. Because in addition to this, he is flesh and prone to proclaiming, publishing, and preaching news, which is considered good and beneficial by those who hear it. So for a period of time, it shall come to be that his days shall be no more than 120 years. There were for a limited period of time the Nephilim, those who prostrate themselves and are stillborn as a result, falling in prayer, in battle, and in status, who are militaristic and thus meet with an untimely death, existing in their region in those days, but also bearing a resemblance to them in a slightly different form for some time thereafter. By association, the sons of the Almighty came to make a habit of pursuing the daughters of man. This would be the female descendants of Adam. And they conceived children for themselves. These warriors and political leaders, prominent individuals with the ability to fight, who prevailed in their quest for military and political power, who were from a relatively long time ago, were individuals with reputations and recognizable names. Bereshit 6:1-4. But I tell you what, just even without the full amplification, you can spend a week just thinking about the implications. What God just say? Yeah, you did.
I did.
So, let's go into 6:1 and 6:2 then with the amplification. And Kirk, you can pick out your favorite words, and we'll go through them. It begins, "When indeed," KY is "when indeed." It's by contrast as a verifiable result. The defilement and the slain. I don't know what is worst, to be defiled or to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a cha'al is conveys both ideas, defiled and dead,
right?
Profane in nature, contemptible in attitude, disgracefully wounding and wounded, deplorable. As one would view pollution, violent, harmful, prone to stabbing. It's from chala, which is a sickening disease, an illness which weakens and grieves. It was written in the hifl, perfect, where the subject causes the object, so these are the perpetrators, cause their victims to participate in the action, which is comprehensive, albeit for a finite period of time. So indeed, when the defilement and slain, did you dig into Shalom?
It was over to check. I was trying to stump a band, and you're just really probably too good. So, but my God, it goes on and on and on and on. It's obviously the pollute and defile and profane and violate, to pierce and to bore. Every word is close to that. Associated with that, whether it be, cutting holes in a pipe to make a flute, is still the same connotation of what you're doing. The chalaka is hapless and unfortunate, wicked, coward, to become helpless, to be dark, unhappy, or wretch, unfortunate, and poor.
It's essentially two ideas.
Okay, like,
to be corrupted, to be defiled, to be dishonorable, to be polluted, to be diseased, to be contemptible, to be profane, is essentially to be dead.
Yeah. Well, you know, the feminine chalatsa is defined as what is stripped off a person, to be spoiled of a plunder of war, spoils from battle, and drawn out from, I assume you could be drawn out from your home or drawn out from your family. It's not a positive thing I can find in here.
Yeah. Now, we, at times in our lives, have been corrupted either with religion or politics or with some other contemptible thing. And the whole benefit of the set apart spirit, the garment of light, when we are born into the covenant as beneficiaries of Pesach, immortality, matzah, perfection, and bokurim, adoption, followed by shabua, empowerment and enrichment, is that from that point on, God sees us as his children. And although we still have our uniquenesses, our proclivities, from God's point of view, we are his children. He loves us unconditionally. But if you don't get cleansed by the light of the set apart spirit through the means that Yahweh has provided through his seven Moed Mikre, then you are defiled, and if you are defiled, you're going to die. If you are profane, which means you're not set apart to him, you're going to die. If you're contemptible, you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that the root of the word speaks of a sickening disease. It's an illness.
Yeah, sickness of the mind, even.
Yeah, you know, it's we as people. In fact, I even had a person write me the other day who was asking if for on their wife's benefit, have you written anything on healing? Because his wife had an issue, and I think this particular issue was she had trouble sleeping. And I said, you know, that's God's not in the business of fixing our bodies. He's in the business of repairing our souls, not our bodies. There's no reason for him to fix our bodies. They're temporary anyway.
They're designed to break down.
Yeah, they are designed to break down. Absolutely. They're designed to be limiting. They're designed to have aches and pains. The contrast.
Think how wicked we would be if it didn't break down.
Oh, my. That's what you said. Yeah, it was limiting life to 120 days, yeah. 120 years for that very reason. Yeah, but what Yahweh is saying here is that the worst ailment isn't smallpox. It isn't influenza. It isn't malaria. It isn't AIDS. It's religion. It's religion,
oh, yeah.
Politics, and militarism that pollute us, that corrupt us, that defile us. And cause us to die in staggering numbers. That's what Sha'al means. So indeed, when the defilement and slain of the descendants of Adam, this is Ha-Adam. Now typically when you see Ha-Adam translated, they forget the definite article. They forget that Adam actually was the name of the first man created with a nesama in the image of Yahweh, the lone individual along with Yahweh in the garden. They pretend that it's just Adam, and they say so that indeed when, and they I don't know how they translate Sha'al, but I'm sure it's not the defilement and slain. And then no. They would just say the descendants of man.
Right.
But it's Ha-Adam.
The Adam.
Yeah. Now, it's of the man, okay. But, you know, Yahweh has a lot of words for man. If he wants to say male individual, it's Ish, Isha, and the feminine. Right. Enoch is mortal man. There are a lot of words, Gadol. For powerful men. A lot of words for men. In this context, the descendants of Adam are very specific individuals. These would be individuals that would be born with a nesama, with a conscience, that Homo sapiens existed by certainly the hundreds of thousands outside of the garden by this time. And maybe by the millions. We know that because when Adam and Chawa left the garden, were escorted out of the garden, they actually wore a sign that could be read, and that they engaged with people that were living in communities. So a lot of Homo sapiens. But the difference is that Adam and Chawa left the garden with an nesama, with this conscience, with this ability to reason. And
yeah,
so
I just looked up.
You
said you didn't know how they translated Sha'al. It's translated as began. I just looked at four different English translations. They translated as began.
Began.
How do they even remotely come to get that?
How do they get that?
I mean, yeah, I even looked. I just pulled up the Strong's definition. This is just, you know, quick look. Strong's definition: a primitive root meaning to bore, to wound, to dissolve, to profane, to break. How do you get began from any of that?
And key is you know used throughout the Torah prophets themselves. Indeed, when, because, by contrast, pay attention, this is verifiable. That's what it means. It doesn't mean.
Uh-huh.
So it's, I was writing the other day about Yahweh and Yirmiyah 26, which is what I'm translating these days. was denouncing mankind. He says, because he says that what each man individually has done is they've created their own variation of his testimony. And so they rendered it in their words like this. And so how is anybody going to know what God said if you don't translate the words accurately? You know, the reason for the flood is laid out before us with Cha'al. It's not the only word, but it's the first word that Yahweh uses to explain the problem. And if all you've got is began, well, that's certainly not going to be a reason to justify rebooting humankind. But anyway, the descendants of Adam were unique in that they carried an Nesama, which is this ability to reason. If you don't understand that, if you miss that, then you're going to miss the whole story. Because everything that follows as to why the sons of God, which would be the descendants of Adam, would choose women for their own goals. They would choose women with an Nesama because that would give children with an Nesama. They'd be much more effective. You know, and then that day, a child, in a lot of ways, grew up to serve the parents. Father. Yeah, the father. So indeed,
don't you have it going both ways, though? I mean, you've got Cain with his descendants who have an Nesama.
Yes, but Cain,
a whole line for him of animalistic people with super brains, supercharged brains.
But Cain is the descendant of Adam, so Cain is a subset.
That's what I mean. You're getting it from both sides. He's choosing women, and then perhaps these guys are now choosing children of Adam's family.
Correct.
So you get it going.
Correct, because all of the women with whom Cain or Adam married, mated with, conceived children with, those children, male and female, would have an Nesama.
Mm-hmm.
It made their daughters extraordinarily. So the daughters that were the descendants of Adam were extraordinarily valuable because their children would have an Nesama. So indeed, when the defilement and the slain of the descendants of Adam came to actually and continually exist, this is Chaya, becoming manifest, written in the call imperfect. So literally, genuinely, actually, on an ongoing basis with unfolding consequences. It increased dramatically. Bad begets bad. Evil begets evil. War begets war. You know, the more America invests in its military, the more it's going to use its military.
Yeah.
You have to justify it.
You're right. The more lands that Rome conquered, the bigger the military it required, the more people it had to conquer to keep its military staffed. Yeah. And then more people they had to tax and rob to pay for that military. Yeah, bad just, people go downhill. It's, once America started to deficit spend, and it was particularly true with FDR in World War II, and then the presidents after him continued on this, well, they deficit, no balanced budgets, let's do things that make me popular now and cause other people to pay for it long after I'm gone. That's the concept of deficit spending. So once you start on that kind of a trend, it increases dramatically. And so God was witnessing not only was mankind defiled and murderous, but the rate of corruption and slain was increasing dramatically.
Yeah, exponential.
Right. upon the presence of the realm of the descendants of Adam. So, you know, at this time, there were, this was 5,000 years ago. At this time, there were Homo sapiens in North America, Central America, South America, throughout Europe. Yeah, China. You know, there's caves and cave pictures. No writing, of course. Writing first appears about this time, about 5,000 years ago is when writing first appears. Evidence of Homo sapiens around the world. God isn't concerned as to what the Homo sapiens without a desalma are doing. For him, they're just an animal. You know, it's like being concerned that the lion hunts for food. It doesn't care. What he cares about is the descendants of Adam in the realm surrounding where the descendants of Adam were living, which would be the area around Eden, which is the area around the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates, which means we're dealing with the Mesopotamia and the area around the Black Sea. That's the area we're dealing with. We're not dealing with the entire world. That's God's focus. And he says, and daughters were born to them. That is the problem, is that the women who were conceived by those with an asama had an asama. That made them extraordinarily valuable. And so the sons of the Almighty, would be anyone with an asama, saw that the daughters of Adam were indeed desirable and beneficial. Toba, facilitating an accumulation of useful things. And so that's why they took them. So they grasped hold and took for themselves women from any which, as a result of their relationship and the benefit their ways, they chose, they desired, they preferred. You know, it's interesting here that
no choice.
Pardon?
The women had no choice.
Yeah, I know. That's the issue. God is delineating what he thinks is so horrible about humankind. And the first word is, of course, this defilement and slain, shalal. But the fact that it's increasing dramatically. But the second is that men were just taking women. Women had no choice. Women became objects. I mean, that's the second thing that God is delineating here that says, I got to rebuke humankind. This is not right. I don't know if you've ever heard that before, but that's, you know, God is laying out the reasons for wiping out humankind with the Masoma, save eight people. And the second reason is that women were being taken as property.
Yeah, there's no volition there.
No volition. Right. No rights, no volition, no love.
No.
No desire for them to be in a caring relationship. It's just that these women were beneficial. Therefore, they took them. Whoever they chose, they took.
Well, what disturbs me, Greg, is if you look the words up, it says all that and just over and over. I mean, it's just you couldn't translate it any differently than you've translated. And I'm not blowing your horn. I'm just saying you just took what anyone should be able to find in these scholars. They even have a reference in with Yilad where it goes to Isaiah 59:4, and the context of that is using the same words, the same term, is to bring forth and conceive iniquity. I mean, that should be a clue. It's in the Hopper.
It should be. You know? Right. Should be a clue.
And I mean, at some point, the tragedy of all this is, how do you translate any other way? I mean, it's bad, you know.
Right. And what's so amazing here, too, is God's talking about the descendants of Adam and the realm of the descendants of Adam.
Right.
And he says, and daughters were born to them. Well, who in the heck are the descendants of Adam? I mean, because the next line is, it says, and the sons of the Almighty, the weirdos that somehow have been hoodwinked into thinking that Enoch was actually written by Enoch. Of course, Enoch didn't write anything.
No.
And the book of Enoch was written around 300 BCE, and it was and remains an utter fraud. But they want to promote the myth that the sons of the Almighty are these angelic beings that are promiscuous.
But John's only written in a couple of Christian lexicons. It's not in all of them. No, most of them don't ever never say that.
You know, the sons of the Almighty here is a reference to the descendants of Adam.
Right.
And the daughters that were born to them, these are not mixed beings that are half spirit and half flesh.
Which can't happen.
A malach.
Yeah.
A malach is an energy-based, light-based being. They do not have sex. They do not have genitalia. They're neither male nor female.
They don't reproduce.
And they have no genitalia at all. And they are, in fact, immortal. There is no reason to have children to prolong to carry on the species. They are immortal. God says that they serve His interest. They aren't out having sex with women here on Earth.
That's like saying the pencil went in and had sex with Minnie Mouse.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, this is straightforward. Okay, so we have two problems so far. We've got an exponential growth and the defilement and the slaying of humankind, particularly the descendants of Adam. And we have women who were the descendants of Adam, who are being taken outside of the construct of marriage, outside of a relationship that is family-oriented, outside of their own free will, so they have no choice in the matter, property. And these are the two things that God is objecting to. Now, as we move through this, it's... I don't think, I mean, maybe, you know, I'm looking at what I wrote here, but the fact of the matter is that it is genuinely impossible in context to translate these words accurately and come up with any other conclusion, but that these were men run amok.
Yeah.
Men abusing women. Yeah, and killing one another and corrupting one another. That's all we got going on here.
Yeah. Well, I guarantee you that's true.
This, by the way, it's one of the things that's interesting here is that a lot of the English Bibles say they took them as wives, and it's Isha M. The YM, well, Ish is male individual. Isha, and the hey at the end, is female individual. Isha-im means female individuals. YM means to create plural in Hebrew. The ah, the hey is the means to make a word feminine. And so there is no justification whatsoever to say that these men that took these women as wives. That's like taking every time that you read ish in Hebrew, which is individual, person, and saying, well, we should render that husband. No, it's male, individual, person.
Yeah.
And Isha is female, individual. To choose wife out of that, listen.
Well,
it's like in Islam when men sell their daughters to be married to somebody. It's not a marriage, not in the sense of any love or choice or free will. The woman's just an object, not a wife. You know, a lot of the hadith talk about Muhammad having his 10 to 20 wives. No, they were slaves, not wives. This is not love in a sense between a husband and wife. No, this is rape. So, English Bibles don't do a very good job of conveying this, which is why people, I think, don't understand.
Yeah, and I suggest that when you have, if you have the female, and prior to that you have Wild Laquok, and then you look up Laquok and it says captured, to be carried away, seized, taken away, to be deprived, to choose and take possession of, kidnapped,
yeah.
Booty, prisoners, and stolen.
Yeah. Yeah, Laquok is,
What the heck is that about a wife? That's just like those little kids in Africa where they took them all, you know, and then they said they all married them off. I mean, no, they raped them all.
Yeah. Now, in a positive context, Lacan can be that you grasp hold of someone. You grasp hold of a child's hand, for example. But in this context, it's grasp hold and took.
Yeah. They didn't walk away well.
Pain. Right. Yeah. This is like those little girls, as you say, in Iraq, that the Islamic State kidnapped, paraded, raped, gang raped, and then paraded naked on stage, and auctioned off as sex slaves, while reciting the Quran to justify it.
And if it was marriage, why would y'all be mad at it?
Right.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, it doesn't say
they ran off and got married.
Adam fell in love with and they chose to engage in a loving relationship and married these women and built families and raised their children to be part of the covenant. There's nothing positive here. Then it says, then Yahweh said, my spirit shall not remain or abide with the descendants of Adam forever. Because additionally, he is flesh and prone to preaching. So for a period of time, it shall exist that his days will be 120 years. This is a devastating statement from a religious point of view, because they want God to be all forgiving and patient, and God said, no, I'm just not going to continue. You know, I can't do this forever. There's a limit to my my patience here. And so God said that there is a profound difference between spirit and flesh. Now He's not saying that flesh is bad. He says, no, you know, I'm gonna give them 120 years. But this idea that you know, I wired human being to live for 1,000 years, that's over. So they just get progressively worse. So let's limit life to 120 years, and so with those who show an interest in forming a relationship with me, I will coexist with them in the flesh for 120 years. That's the maximum. I'm just not going to go beyond that, because to go beyond it, they turn south. They devolve. They get worse. So Yahweh said, "My spirit shall not remain or abide with the descendants of Adam, because additionally," this is Gam. So I think in this particular case, guys, Gam is an essential word, because God has laid out the two criterion to justify the flood. Man was profane and deadly is number one, and number two, he's abusive to women. He was usurping women's free will, but taking women outside of the confines of a loving family relationship, mother, father, husband, wife, that God had envisioned.
Well, look what Islam does to women after a while. They all become just as bad, if not worse.
Right. And that's why we're going to find with the Nephilim that Yahweh says there's some people that are a lot like them at a future date.
Yeah.
So God is saying that there's an additional problem here. And the additional problem is that he had wired our, programmed our DNA such that we would be able to live a lot longer. And he had to reprogram the DNA. So, you know, 1,000 years sounds like a lot to us. It's not very long to God. But living that long, most people went from bad to worse. And so he just says, you know, they're just not going to pursue human souls for 1,000 years. I'm going to 120 years is the amount of time that I'm going to limit this. And that was another issue. Now, I want to share some of the things that, and some of this came from Roy. Some of this I developed myself. I'm not claiming to be right, but I do want to share what I came to realize as I began to study this. So the first thought was the time had run out for every man and woman within the Selma, a conscience, save Noah and the seven souls with him. The timing of this is 2968 BCE. This is year 1000, yeah. It will expire once again, this time for everyone who fails to embrace the covenant prior to 2033 CE, year 6,000 Yah, exactly 5,000 years after the flood. Now, Yahweh's spirit is akin to light, which makes it like energy. As such, it is eternal. Our physical bodies are comprised of matter and are thus mortal. One cannot reside with the other beyond a finite period of time. To become immortal, to enter Yahweh's presence, to become like him, to inherit the benefits of the covenant, and to be empowered and enriched, we have to jettison our physical bodies and be transformed into light. You know, this whole concept of a bodily resurrection that both Muslims and Christians believe in, it's absurd.
It can't happen.
Oh, God, it's counterproductive. You want to get rid of the
physical. Speaking of someone with a beat and broken body, I'm ready to get rid of it.
Yeah, I mean, you've abused your body pretty good these last couple of years. You know?
Yeah,
I will say that when I went through that period with the systemic poison ivy, I was real happy with mine. You know, and mine's breaking down. I don't hear as well as I used to. My hearing is failing. My eyesight is definitely failing. You know, both knees are painful. I'm prone to twist my back, as you know, from time to time. I've got aches and pains. I never once asked Yahweh to fix them. I'm delighted that he's chosen to fix something infinitely more valuable, which is my soul. And what God is saying here is that, folks, bodily resurrection, this whole basis, you know, a Islamic suicide bomber will wrap their private parts in gauze so that they're ready to go with the virgins. I don't know what a penis wholly severed from a mutilated body is going to do and why that's going to be a grand thing. But, you know, that is the last thing I'm concerned about taking with me. But that's the whole thing about Christians, Muslims. They think that they're going to have physical bodies. And
right, you ask most Christians their idea of heaven, they're going to give you a very physical description of, you know,
of course,
going to have mansions and this. And
right,
it's all
right.
Physical.
Physical. Oh, yeah. In fact, everything in the Islamic heaven is physical. It's rivers that flow with wine and comfy couches and beds and perpetual virgin
boy.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's all physical kinds of things.
It's the same thing as their idea of hell.
Yeah, and one of the problems is you can't go past the four dimensions with a physical body. You can't even maneuver in four dimensions with a physical body.
No.
You can't go from four to five with a physical body. You have to jettison the physical body. And this notion that you could be eternally with a physical body, you know, they want their Jesus Christ to be resurrected bodily. Well, if he's got a physical body, the entire length of time that Yahweh's spirit can endure with him is 120 years. It's over. 120 years, man, that's it for a physical body. So you better be able to figure out a way to be transitioned to spirit, or your time with Yahweh is limited to 120 years. I mean, you've got to think it through. One of the words here that is always rendered flesh, and that's not even its primary meaning, is basar. Kirk, did you do a search on basar? Yeah.
I did, Steve, yes, sir.
And the verbal root of Bashar is written exactly the same way.
Uh-huh.
And the verbal root does not mean flesh. It means proclaiming, publishing, and preaching news considered good and beneficial by those who hear it.
I thought it was a little hard. You have to dig a little bit deeper than most of them, and you have to get some. But yes, indeed, it starts out with the simple flesh, you know, like flesh and bone or whatever. But then it becomes thrown to preaching. And it was interesting. There was another one, this flesh of bulls, which I thought was very funny.
Yeah, but Kirk, the mother's milk of correctly translating nouns is to search for the verbal root, the
verbal
actionable
root.
It's the actionable root of a word that defines it.
Uh-huh.
You know, Kadash, which means renewed or restored, is based on Kadash, which means to renew or to restore. It's every Hebrew word that has a known verbal root, the actionable root of the word defines the noun. 100% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the verb, bashar, and the noun, bashar, are written exactly the same way. Same three letters.
Right.
B-S-R.
That's not in the tell, yeah.
Yep. Those are the three letters. Mm-hmm. And the verbal root does not in any way, shape, or form even mention flesh or body or physical being. The verbal root is to preach, is to proclaim, is to publish, is to convey news which is considered good and beneficial to those who hear it. You know, if you were to ask a Christian, what does gospel mean? They're going to say, oh, it's the good news. Right. Yeah.
Let me correct something. I meant to say a bet shin and a roach, not a...
Uh-huh.
I was using another root word, so figure me on that, yeah. But the
show. Yeah.
But let me share something who you and JB might like this. It's, when it got to Bashar, it says, to bear good news. So I wrote in Evangelion. Good news, to proclaim, to carry a message. To preach good tidings to the meek. To preach, to publish, to carry the news to people.
All Christian connotations, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
And but the problem here is, if you're saying, if you're a Christian, you say, well, see, God's got
me.
Yeah, he's agreeing. The gospel is a good Hebrew term. He's using this, saying that his spirit won't endure with man for more than 120 years because he is the Shar.
Yeah.
So the Shar is the problem. So
yeah,
the good
is,
news
is
that you would consider your gospel, Chris, the problem. That's how the term is used here. That's a that's a really bad thing.
Yeah. There's some associated words. One of them is which I found really odd, and I was trying to think about it, to an increase of sour spoiled grapes. And it was bad, and I was thinking about, well, that's got to be, I'm stretching a little bit perhaps, but, you know, bad fruit, the metaphor about bad fruit. And then it was with a B-Ain and an Aleph, it's a man's view of Yah, to swell up, boil over, to ask questions, to seek and to pray. These are all the ones, you know, when you get when you click on a word and you get another
this root
and so forth, and then BAAD was to separate. So you've got a fuming, asking, question, praying Paul.
Yeah.
Paul being a symbol of all our of all those religions, mostly Christian, and then also the verb of falling or in a it's also BAAD is a circulatus. A circle root or the circular reason.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all these little connected tissues.
Yeah.
I guess the connected words.
Yeah. Thinking of circular reasoning and circuitous. In fact,
which is what I was trying to say.
You think about Christianity, of course. The Pauline doctrine is all written on Gnosticism. Flesh is bad, spirit is good, and the whole purpose of that was to denounce the covenant because it it had as one of the requirements circumcision. So flesh is bad. Well, if flesh is bad, then why is God dying? The physical body of God dying and the physical body of God being resurrected. Good.
Important at all.
Yeah. How can that be good? How can you have a physical body, a God being being a physical human being, God as a physical human being being killed, and then as a physical human being being resurrected, all in the flesh, if you're a Christian, how can that be good if the flesh is bad? I mean, it's somebody needs to think it through. It's astonishing how conflicting Christianity is. But anyway, the primary meaning of Bashar is not flesh. Its verbal root reveals the actual reason Yahweh's spirit could not endure with man. Humankind had become overtly religious, proclaiming, publishing, preaching, and news considered good and beneficial by those who hear it.
So why does it take 2,000 years for somebody to figure that out?
I
know it's rhetorical.
I don't know.
But it's just like, well, it's all right there. Somebody had to write all these lexicons. Didn't they read them when they wrote them?
Yeah. You know, I think that we are indeed special. That we're only special because we've taken what God said seriously and followed where his words lead. But that has made us extraordinarily special. Not among men, not among women, but with him. Now, this the whole limitation of 120 years is still in effect. It was in effect from that day 5,000 years ago. Even with all of man's scientific and medical advancements, the longest human lifespan was that of Jeanine Calment of France. She was a woman, not a man. She died in 1997 at 122 years old. Women have the capacity to live longer because they have two X chromosomes, while men have just one. Once one is damaged, there isn't a second option to fall back on, is the issue with men versus women. The second oldest woman, Susanna Jones, an American, she died in May 2016 at 116. The longest-lived man in recorded history was Jeroen Kimura of Japan. He died in 2013, 4 years shy of 120 years. While they are all dead, the oldest living man is Yisrael Crystal. He's a Israelite. He was born in September 1903 and is therefore between 113 and 114 years old. When Yahweh makes a statement, he gets it right. The length of a human life is determined largely by our genes. Human cells are limited in number of divisions that they will support. They progressively lose telomeres with each subsequent cell partition until a few short telomeres become uncapped, leading to an arrest of growth known as replicative aging. While these cells do not die initially, in the absence of genomic alterations, the telomere DNA remain quiescent, producing different proteins than younger cells. But then once a tipping point is reached and many of the telomere ends become uncapped, the propensity of critically shortened telomeres to divide leads to rapid cell death and thus puts our bodies into crisis. There is, however, an enzyme called telomerase, which can lengthen clipped telomeres. Unfortunately, it has the side effect of promoting malignancy. That's a bad side effect. This should not be surprising since cancer is caused by rapidly replicating cells. The potential reward, the ability to provide a lifespan of up to 1,000 years, has global pharmaceutical companies salivating, since it would create the fabled fountain of youth. Genetic research scientists are trying to find a solution to the lifespan limitation of telomere DNA without deadly side effects, such as telomerase-induced cancer. So while it is unlikely that man will solve this challenge prior to year 6000 Yah, 2033, at least with a drug that will be widely available, the fact that DNA, which is the language of life, can be edited to lengthen and shorten a human lifespan has profound implications regarding the interpretation of the Torah. For example, Adam and Chawa's DNA would have been programmed such that it prevented cell sinnings indefinitely. But then, the information contained in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil may have altered our initial script such that it started the aging clock ticking. Adam, Chawa, and those related to them would have had the capacity to live up to around 1,000 years.
Hmm.
Thereafter, since he authored the Code of Life, Yahweh could have edited and did our DNA such that 120 years would be the upward limit of human existence. As such, the oldest of the last generation conceived with the capacity to witness Yahweh's return would have been born in 1913, the darkest year in American history. The year the Federal Reserve was clandestinely created, commencing the destruction of the currency. The federal income tax was established to control everyone by redistributing wealth, all while Woodrow Wilson was secretly scheming to develop and deploy the disease errantly called the Spanish flu. It was an anthrax-based disease, chemical weapon that would ultimately become the world's most lethal plague of death. 1913 is when they would be born for 120 years. Looking ahead, those who are born to covenant parents during the millennial Shabbat of Sukkah will likely have their DNA reprogrammed such that it will again have the potential to live for 1,000 years. So as is the case with so many things we have discovered in the Torah, from 6 days of creation accurately representing the 13.7 to 14.7 billion years of creation, depending on the temperature of court confinement, depending on whose clock one is considering, the asteroid impact, upwelling of seawater which led to the flood, or now the reduction in human lifespans, Yahweh's explanations are not only plausible, they have been validated scientifically. Now, moving to the next statement. Personally, I'm appalled at the number of conspiracy advocates who promote the myth that the Nephilim were giant spiritual beings who mated with human women. Many use the Book of Enoch, which our pal here, JB, is an expert.
Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert, but I spent enough time in it to know that it's garbage.
Yeah. It's an outright fraud.
That's about 2 minutes. You can figure that out, though.
You have that posted, don't you, Jamie, for people to read?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right there on his website on yahwehbereth.com. The Nephilim were not giants. They weren't even particularly tall. But they were religious, and they were also militant, becoming a living embodiment of the things God hates most. We know this about them because this depiction serves as the basis of their name. So this is now Bereshith in the beginning, 6:4. Now, there were the Nephilim. Ha, Nephilim, turn to that in a minute, existing in the region in those days, but also by comparison in a slightly different form, they existed for some time thereafter. By association, the sons of the Almighty came to the daughters of man, and they conceived children for themselves. These warriors and political leaders, who hailed from a relatively long time ago, are individuals with reputations and recognizable names. So the first word there is, after the verb, there were Haya. For a limited period of time, they actually and literally existed. This is called imperfect. The Nephilim.
Right.
Nephilim is, as I sought to translate it, and Kirk, you probably looked into this, it means those who prostrate themselves and are still there. It's from the verbal root, Nephal. To fall in prayer, battle and status, going from a higher position to a lower one, those who are separated and die, those who bow down, prostrating, falling prostrate to worship something on the ground, those who neglect and are thereby neglected, those who attack to conquer in an offensive military action, becoming inferior in the process, those who are subject to miscarriage and thus untimely death.
I found all that in so much that, I wrote down and I said, okay, you said they're tyrants and they're warlike and they are fall down in prayer and they're equivalent of a miscarriage. You talk about their status. So I took all of those and I looked through, I did it after the fact, but I took all of those off to the side. And then I just looked up everything I found on the phylum, and it was so over. Can you find giants hardly at all? I mean, that's when some little Christian guy wrote it in, as a new quote.
Giants exist only for one reason. It's the same reason that if you look up Yosha, you'll find Jesus. It's lexicons trying to justify their own translations. There are places where you will find the bogus references. That's why you've got to have a religious filter. But when you study the roots of the word, you go, wait a minute, there is nothing that suggests giant, tall, big. I mean, if Nephal were the word for giant, wouldn't Goliath be a Nephal?
Well, you would think he would.
Yeah. But he wasn't.
No, it's only because they have Gabor associated with him, which Gabor just means large. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, prominent. Yeah, prominent. But Gabor typically is a man of war. It's typically a prominent politician or a man of war. This is, you know, this is a somebody that's full of themselves is a Gabor.
No fault.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Warriors and political leaders, prominent individuals with the ability to fight, who prevailed. But what actually Gabor does is it define Nephil. Nephilim is just the plural of Nephil. So mm-hmm. Gabor helps to define. But there's nothing that says giant about Gabor.
No.
Doesn't mean giant.
No, it just is mightiest among beasts or animals or something like that. You know, mighty warriors. That's not giant.
No, it's not giant. No. No. Well, you know, there's a fight that's coming up, and there's two pipsqueaks. Mayweather and who's the Irish lad that's fighting him? McGregor. I think both guys are like 5'6" or something, 5'7". I mean, they're little guys.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're big-time fighters.
Oh, yeah.
They're not giants. They're just big-time fighters. That's what Gabor is. He's a big-time fighter. You know, the attack helicopter and the AK-47, they do not care about the stature of the man pulling or woman pulling the trigger.
No.
So you were studying Nephilim. The
Nephil. Yeah. I started with Nephilim, and that gave me tyrants and bullies. Obviously, it's a misquote on the giant when a few of them use that. Most of them don't. That I ran across. They were battling warriors. Then you go to Nephuism. Nephuism. I may be mispronouncing, but 5304, just one over. And it's a scattered expansions, temple servant. You've got Nephilim, which is a city of the Moabs, and the only reason that's kind of important, I thought, because it also means a gust or breath or blowing of air, but it does in the context of boiling breath, caused to lose life, seething, and yeah, and right off to the side, egomaniac Paul and his rants.
Yeah, right.
To exhale, to get out of breath, to blow on a fire, and so forth and so on. So it goes on. Then there's Nephishim, 5305, if you like the numbers. This was interesting. It was son of Ishmael and his posterity.
Yeah. Well, of course, because the final, you know, and then the Islam, people that exist in a different form for a different time thereafter. And then the final are describing Muslims.
Yeah,
I'm not trying to pick on Muslims here unfairly because Islam is a big deal to Yahweh. Islam exists as a death cult to rid the world of the chosen people.
Right.
So it is a holy satanic religion committed to wiping out Israelites, and so. For Yahweh to use a term and say, you know, these people are going to, in a slightly different form, come to exist sometime thereafter, it's really important that we understand what Nephil means and what is the signature move of a Muslim.
Oh,
prostration prayer, right? Prostration prayer, right?
All day long, 5 times a day.
Right, right. Yeah. And the second would be jihad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you were to take the two dominant themes of Nephil, you'd have prostration prayer and jihad militancy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, falling
and
to
all
those
are listed also in the fall. Yeah, and you go in the fall and it goes on and on and on, especially. Violent deaths, experience calamity, prostrate yourself before someone or something to...
untimely death.
Fall at the hand of power to be offensive, to supplicate. In essence, be religious and mean SOB, son of Baal.
Right. Yeah. To fall in prayer, battle, and status.
Yeah.
That's a definition of Islam.
So everything you highlighted in there, that's is easily found if you don't mind looking up a lot.
Yeah,
so it's hard to find.
Yeah, so the first thing you've got to do if you want to find it, is the very first thing you've got to do is to understand that that you're looking at Nephil. The YM just makes it plural. And Nephil is, it's not hard to find the verbal root. It's Nephal. And Nephal does not mean giant.
No.
Nephal is prayer, battler status.
Yeah. And then when you're
in worship.
And then after that, when you got to Gabor,
mm-hmm.
and you started breaking that, I started breaking that down, and just to toss this into Ty, that was what we were just talking about, is when you have Gabor, strong, mighty, arrogant, magnified, and then it says, see Exodus 17:11. And that's the story, and I said, so I clicked on that, and I went to Moshe, and he's battling the Amalekites with Hur and Yosha.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, okay, over here, you've got Moshe, you've got the same thing, the Amalekite son of Ishmael and his posterity, and then over here, Gabor. So I think it's funny how Yahweh keeps weaving these little things in there. Those are fun to me. Fine. I mean, it may not mean anything to anybody, but I thought that's really cool. You know, everywhere you look.
No, but one of the ways
you're
trying to turn the
story over and over,
how God uses
it. You can't miss
it
if you read. Yeah,
right. That's the whole idea of the journey of discovery. So the Nephilim were Gadol. They were Gabor. They were Gabor. They were prominent individuals with the ability to fight, who prevailed in their quest for military and political power, warriors and political leaders.
And made everybody bow
down. Yep. Now, what God is saying here, and he says it twice, that this is going to repeat itself, and he also says that that these people made a name for themselves. That throughout time, throughout time, what do? We revere men of war. Well, look at in America, George Washington. George Washington. He was the general who led a war against the Britons.
Roosevelt.
Patton and Eisenhower. Warriors.
What did he want to be?
Yeah.
Look at Mount Rushmore.
Right.
Look at the faces on Mount Rushmore. How many of them were men of war?
Right. Well, look at Lincoln. I mean, he was extraordinarily man of war, guys. His wars caused the death of over 600,000 Americans. But you look at Alexander the Great, man of war. Julius Caesar, man of war. Augustus Caesar, man of war.
Tiberius, all of them.
Tiberius, man of war. Men of war are those that in history are the best known. That's just the way that, you know, Ulysses in the Iliad and the Odyssey. They're all men of war. And, you know, look at FDR and how famous he is in America. Man of war. So God's saying that, you know, these individuals are known. They have recognizable names, those who are warriors and political leaders. This is a list of things that God does not like. So man's heroes are not God's heroes. Man's heroes are the people that God says, I'm not going to endure with. They made a reputation among man, but they're not part of my family. Now, what we're going to do, and we'll do this in a future show, I think that the corruption of Nephilim is so interesting that what I want to do is devote, it might be an entire show, maybe a couple of shows, to where that led, looking at the history of Bible translations and how one just regurgitated the other's mistake, and how you get such rubbish in Bible translations, because God is defining why it is that he is going to wipe out humankind with an Asama in this area surrounding Eden. And he is telling us that these same set of circumstances are going to prevail again under different names in different places with different people. This is really important stuff to understand the mindset of God, what he absolutely despises in human nature. It's the very thing that man praises. Like, you know, they're saying, yeah, I'm such a great president because I'm a military man. I'm going to increase the size of the U.S. military. It's the very thing that God
enables these guys. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to enable killing. I'm going to enable violence. Wrong thing to do. So we'll study in the fall and we'll consider English translations of it that have rendered it incorrectly. And there's a lot to learn. I think one of the most revealing studies that I've ever done was the study that came out of Nepal here, which is trying to understand the history of English Bible translations and how we got ourselves in such a horrible mess.
Don't you think when you're confronted with the Christians and they always, you know what they're going to say to you? They always say to you that, well, why doesn't God, if he loves everybody, why doesn't he do that? Why doesn't he stop this? And the thing that's helped me the most, I should say, is knowing that, understanding volition, he cannot jump in there and do this. He did promise you that he would. You turn to him, he'll turn to you and protect you. So that's a non-issue. So you're not going to get hurt. But he's not going to protect everybody.
He doesn't love everybody. The premise is wrong.
And he don't love everybody to begin with. No, he said you're not
welcome. Love everybody. He doesn't want to save everybody.
You.
Yeah. Doesn't know everybody. Doesn't want to save everybody. Doesn't want to live eternally with everybody.
No.
If you want to put in the effort. Your mind is open. Your attitude is right. You want to pursue coming to know Yahweh. You can know him. Between the three of us, we've all done a fair amount of translating. We've all studied the words that he's used. None of us have any training that would impress anybody.
No.
No.
Yeah.
We could do it. We did it.
Yes, we can.
It's been available to others to do. It's a combination of you got to want to do it. You've got to, when you learn something from God that is contrary to what you have previously been told, you've got to be willing to reject the religious or political lie and replace it with Yahweh's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of people are willing to do that. You know, how many people said, well, I don't want to have to learn Hebrew?
No, give them a short version, CW.
Yeah, and part of the reason they want to learn Hebrew is they hate all things Hebrew.
No.
Jews, Israel, the Feast of Yahweh, the language. They hate them.
When I was about 9 or 10 years old, we were playing baseball, and a friend of mine, Jerry, came over to the house where we were going. We used to go to the Little League. And he said he can't come anymore because he has to learn Hebrew at the synagogue. And I thought, gee, that's great, because I thought Jews were really cool.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus was a Jew. And most of them. So I'm going to Yoshua, of course. So I told my mama, I said, I'd like to learn that. Can I go with him? And she said, absolutely not. And I said, well, why? She said, never mind.
Never mind. Absolutely.
Yeah,
not.
I was really disappointed. I thought that would be really cool because I knew Israel in Hebrew, even to learn, you know, it took me forever before I actually got around to doing a little bit of it. I couldn't speak it. I still haven't learned it. I just look over words to see what they mean.
The problem, of course, is that if you actually spoke modern Hebrew,
that'd be a different language than what we're doing here.
You'd be at a disadvantage.
I would.
You'd be a disadvantage.
You really would. I agree with that. I wasn't always sure at first, but I'm absolutely convinced now.
Yeah. And by the way, those are religious Jews that that study the language. They study it to read the Talmud and the Mishnah and that sort of thing, not to try to accurately convey a message from his Torah. And I think we're actually at an advantage to be independent upon the tools, the lexicons, the interlinears, all of that sort of thing. And particularly if you're unwilling to take anything at face value.
Mm-hmm.
Turn over every stone. Examine everything under a microscope. Look at the related words. Look at the oldest manuscripts. Consider the each word with the diacritical markings of the 11th century CE Masoretes removed.
Yeah.
Look at each word spelled the same way or very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the first time a word's used in the Torah. Come to know just some of the basics, like the hey at the end of the word making it feminine. A basic like the YM making it plural. Like the verbal root defining the meaning of a noun. Just some of the basics. Spend the time.
Well, they criticize you a lot on your first couple of books because you hit the highlights, I'm not bragging. It is obvious to me that what you were doing is getting the major points to get so you have a clear understanding of what this is about, and then you can flesh out all that other stuff. Somebody would always say, well, why don't you have the whole Bible? You don't have enough lifetime to write all this stuff, and so much of it is superfluous. What we're doing anyway, I'm trying to understand.
No.
What does he want? What's important to him?
Right.
What should be important to me if I want a relationship with him?
Mm-hmm. I started on a path of translating Yeshaya from 1:1 through the end of the 14th chapter. And that's what Observations is going to be. And then, it really opens up with Proverbs. And Proverbs 6, 7, and 8, kind of dominate the opening of it. And then as we start down and move into it, we find, well, even now we have to go through and form the basis in Shamuel. We had chapters devoted to it. And then words would come up this is a really interesting term. Let's pursue this and see what we can learn. And pretty soon you realize there isn't enough time in my life to even accomplish the original goal of getting through 1 through 14 for observations. And that's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. It is okay. It's, as you're continuing to learn.
11, 12 years, you're going to know it all.
Yeah. That's right.
And you'll have
the joy is coming.
So and I can throw my English away. So what the heck?
What do you say, JB?
I said the joy is in coming to know. It's like any relationship. Building the relationship is what makes the relationship. If you just have this information dump, it wouldn't be as enjoyable.
It's translating his work. Coming up with understanding and insights is the fun part. So I'd much rather spend a third of my time translating and two-thirds of my time deriving insights and understanding from it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I wouldn't have any interest in, I am certain that if you really pursued all of the names in Bamidbar numbers, that you could come up with some fairly profound insights.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of time necessary to derive those insights would be significant. And you can learn so much more that's relevant today to go elsewhere You know, why do I want to go through the genealogical tables of numbers just because it's in the Torah? I'm sure that there is great value in understanding it all. But there's, you've got all these pearls that are like hot in front of us.
Yeah.
Elsewhere, why would I want to go trip over all the pearls?
I don't spend almost any time at all in the Greek text. Yeah, there is insight to be gained there, but the amount of effort you have to put forth versus what you gain from it is just so disproportionate that I can go do. I can go look in. I've been spending a lot of time in Yirmiyah right now, and I get much more out of that with a lot less effort than I would.
Yeah, Yirmiyah is really profound. I mean, almost anywhere you turn in Yirmiyah. As I say, I'm retranslating that 26 now, and oh my goodness. It's just everything is just so enormously insightful and profound. God is so clear. And so, you're right. Why? There's so much to learn. Just almost no matter where you turn, there's things to learn. And the whole purpose of the translation is to inspire insights and understanding.
Well, it would be awful not to hit all the prophecies real hard in the end time prophecies when we're sitting right here in the midst of it. And the most
correct,
just nothing else, just to warn people. Look, this is real. This is what he said.
Mm-hmm.
This is exactly what he said, and there's no question about it. You can prove it yourself,
mm-hmm.
and you can see it all happening right now. This is a trustworthy guide, the Torah.
Yes. Yeah. And particularly now we're talking about Noach. Means trustworthy guy.
Trustworthy guy.
All right. So we will pursue the how Nephilim became giants in virtually every English translation, that's going to just to lead to a whole investigation as to how English Bibles. Came to be so corrupt, and personally, I think it's really an interesting story. I will even get to Eusebius. This is Jerome. His real name was Eusebius Sophronius, and what his stated reason was for the Latin Vulgate. It's just mind-boggling. When you read that, you go, oh, my
it's
God.
Rude, ain't it?
Oh, it's just so rude. It's right there in your face. The letters he wrote to the Pope as to why he wanted to do this. And then you begin to look at the disease that became the Textus Receptus and how that fraud ended up being embraced by Protestant Christianity. It's just amazing what men will do and how despicable we are.
Yeah.
So we'll go through the whole thing, the history of translation and how ultimately Yahweh's testimony was so corrupted that it now becomes hard to know him. You've got to work at it. You've got to be willing to put in the time. Well, folks, it's been a great time. I'm glad you're back, JD.
Yeah, always.
Yeah, it was fun to hear this. I'm glad you had the good road trip. And Captain Kirk, we didn't get to do the observation show today.
No, there was no today. Yeah.
Yeah, that worked out for me. I've my youngest son is in town. I've got to put my Labrador down. Scheduled for tomorrow,
sorry.
I might postpone it this Thursday. Yeah, it's kind of a drag. You know, she's 13 years old, but she's now completely blind, and she's essentially deaf, she's fairly lame. Life is really tough for her, and she doesn't seem to be suffering, but she bumps into things all the time now, and she can't go up and down stairs, and it's just really—it's really tough. So, my son's in town. He's going to kind of celebrate her life here the next couple of days. I got my granddaughter coming in tomorrow, and I got to spend the day with him. as opposed to doing the observation show. So it worked out pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a board to do the show on GCN.
Yeah.
All right, fellas. Well, we'll talk with you next week. Thank you so much. Happy Shabbat.
Oh, thank you. Good night, Judy.
Okay. Have a good Shabbat.
Okay, bye-bye.